This is the CAG podcast about clerics of the Empire, CAG clerics. What is a Klingon cleric? Tonight, our guest is Troy Pacella. I hope I pronounced that right, Pacella. Troy. Pacella, yeah.
That's okay.
Not good on Italian.
Yeah, I'm a wild mix here, Italian Klingon. That's a rough thing to be.
But I guess your Klingon name is Kartan?
Kartan, yeah.
Kartan?
Yep.
Okay, let's jump right into this.
What exactly
is a Klingon cleric?
That's a great question. A simple answer from shall we say, out of character point of view, would be just go and check out the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Rightful Heir, and you literally see the Klingon clerics, right? Worf is going through a spiritual crisis, and he asks for leave from his duties so that he could return to the Empire, go to the planet Boreth, where there is a monastery.
And not burn down the Enterprise in the process.
Well, exactly. That'll be a topic for another day. The topic of holographic versus real. Fire, candles, you know, bonfires and so forth used in for ceremonial purposes. Exactly right. He needs to get equilibrium, right? Reconnect with the warrior spirit. And that obviously exists for the Klingons on the planet Boreth. So it was based on that I was kind of inspired to kind of dig into that role for Klingons in fandom, specifically in several different Klingon clubs that I belong to besides CAG. The talk, you know, the question was, well, what role do you serve on the ship? And I would be hard pressed to remember the details of this conversation, but I remember the spirit of it. We joked about what would a ship's counselor be like for the Klingons. And I thought about it and I said, well, I don't think they would have, you know, the fandom joke is, you know, you go to a ship's counselor on a Klingon ship, they backhand you and they say, snap out of it, right? But when I thought about it a little bit more with a more critical, thought process, I realized that, the clerics of Boreth, in a way, were very much like that kind of a spiritual guide when you need to get your head straight as a warrior. It's a little bit different concept. It's not, you know, the psychology and the feelings and the all. It's the philosophy and the warrior way. And that got me thinking about things like the ship's chaplain in the Navy, right? Who was there to serve a spiritual purpose, but oftentimes a more generalized spiritual purpose. That minister might have to help Catholics, other Protestant Christians, even more agnostic people. And so their religious services on a Sunday, for example, might be much more generalized. So I started really digging into, well, what do we have from Lord? And for the longest time, we only had that one episode, the Monastery of Boreth, which was really good stuff, right? That's where you see the robes that they wore. You got the gist of what it was. But then I found as I would talk about this at conventions and so forth, people would be like, well, wait a minute. You know I saw that episode and whatnot, but is it really a cleric, right? Is it really, you know, what we think of as religious, right? Because Worf specifically said they didn't have a religion in terms of gods, right? That, you know, in Klingon mythology, the Klingons had destroyed their gods. They'd killed them all. The reason that Worf gave was they were more trouble than they were worth. And, you know, even a line like that says a lot more than it might appear. You dig into that, and the first thing I think is, well, you know, if you were to ask somebody on Earth about some matter of faith, you would have one person say something from a Catholic point of view. You would have someone else disagree with them from a Protestant point of view. You might have a Jew who says you're all wrong, an agnostic saying I think you guys read way too much into the Bible. I don't think it's that literal. You know, there, I believe there's something, but I'm not sure you guys got it right. And then you might have an atheist who goes, you're all crazy. There's no such thing. One of the things you struggle with in Star Trek is there tends to be a very stereotyping of races, right? But we have seen so much of the Klingons that we know that for every belief, everything that Worf says, everything, you know, you get from a single line, it's oftentimes contradicted by someone else. And that's either, okay, well, these writers just don't know what they're doing, they're not paying attention, or I think more likely, Klingons are way more diverse than, you know, any one throwaway line can cover. I definitely feel that Worf has a very specific philosophical and mythological belief, and I get the distinct impression Gowron is more what I would consider like an agnostic. He believes, okay, it's not literal, okay, the things that we believe about Kalis and so forth. Whereas the clerics of Borath kind of took a somewhat literal interpretation and tried to reinvigorate that conservative belief, if you will. Again, cleric is a human word. It may not be the best descriptor. Things oftentimes don't translate. I tend to use the term Laldan Shov Chohui, okay? Which is like leader of religious ceremonies, a teacher of religious or philosophical practices. Other, I don't know, if expanded universe or whatever. If you play or if you're aware of Star Trek Online, you go to the Klingon homeworld and right out in front of the Great Hall, there is two people standing there and Klingon on either side of the entrance, and they are referred to as Kun Bomui, which is lore singer. Or if you go with the Bach, it refers to the lore screamer. I'm sure they're related. But it's this idea of someone who stands outside the Great Hall, just, I guess you know, on Earth, the equivalent would be a street preacher, you know, just telling the tales of Kalis and maybe doing some, like a homily, I suppose, about why these things are important, especially today, and, you know, so on and so forth. I really do believe that, and of course, a lot of this is just headcanon, but I would imagine that if we take, for example, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of the episode, you guys might remember it better. There was an episode where it introduced Worf's brother, Kern, and he was acting in an exchange capacity with Commander Riker, and Riker served.
Jim, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I think that was Sins of the Father.
Yes, that was the one where Worf's brother replaced Riker on the Enterprise as first officer. I think the one Kartan is referring to is A Matter of Honor, where Riker was an exchange officer on the Pock.
But the important thing is Riker was serving as a human first officer aboard the Pa, I believe was the name of the ship, and kind of getting the experience of what it was like how it was very different to serve aboard a Klingon ship. Well, if we have these kinds of exchanges, right, is it not, and it was truly a cultural exchange for both sides to learn from the other, would it not be entirely possible that this concept of a ship's counselor or chaplain, I'm sure that Starfleet might also have a chaplain as well, although they've never focused on it or shown it, wouldn't the Klingons look at that and go, hey, yeah, that might be something that we could get the clerics of Borath. They could position someone or have, you know, an acolyte or whatever serving on Imperial ships, and, you know, they could serve that role rather than us having to do regular pilgrimages to Borath and so forth. So yeah, that's the basic idea behind it. So what is it that I talk about as a cleric serving aboard a ship, going to conventions, cultural exchanges, and so forth? Obviously, history, right? I'm going to talk about Kalish. I'm going to talk about the unification of the Empire. The great thing about Klingon lore is the history and the mythology are very closely related. If you are a student of history on Earth, you know that our concept of understanding history, archaeology, and trying to get down to what really happened, where people came from, where cultures came from, how language evolved, things like this. The truth of history is a very new concept, because up until really only a couple hundred years ago, mythology and history were very much like the Klingon concept. They were one and the same. This is what we were told happened, so this is the way it was. If you were a literal interpreter of the Bible, then Adam and Eve were the first man and woman, and we're all descended from them, and that's just the way it is. And as time went on, scientists started to go, yeah, but is that really true? And so now you have some people that are a little bit more progressive and say, okay, well, it was just an allegory. It wasn't literal truth. And you still have some people that go, no, that's absolutely literally true. So a Klingon cleric would absolutely have to start to consider, well, you may not believe that Kalis literally created the first Spotleth by quenching a lock of his hair in the lava of Kreestok, you know, and forged it with his own hands. Maybe someone, you know, some great warrior created a weapon, called it the Batleth, and the carbon that he used to harden the steel, he used his own hair. So, you know, maybe it's not a literal interpretation, but the spirit is definitely there. The story is built up, and you know, was Kalis the real person? Or, I mean, we have those same same debates about Moses. Was he a real person, or was he just allegorical, or, you know, was he taken from someone else's mythology? And what did they say in Rightful Heir? You know, does it really matter if the stories are true? There is truth in them, and we are Klingons because of the lesson we learn from the story, maybe not the literal truth. You know, it may not be necessary to know the literal truth.
And I think it's more important with Klingon mythology that it doesn't need to be the literal truth, because Kalis was teaching a philosophy more than a strict parable.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. For example, Gowron challenges the clone of Kalis. He, you know, when he's telling the story of the foolish man who did not respect the wind, and he said, "Well, what was the man's name?" Basically, getting at there's gaps in your story, because you know a story, you weren't really literally there. This didn't really literally happen. Well, I get what Gowron was trying to do. But that would be like, you know, a Christian saying to Jesus Christ, you know, this parable that you told, what was that guy's name? Jesus would have looked at him and said, this didn't really happen. I'm just telling a story to make a point.
In many cases, aren't legends based on something factual?
Yes, I have to believe they are. But the debate then becomes how much of it is truth. Like, for example, you know, I made reference to Moses. Let's instead of Moses, let's talk about Noah, right? Noah and the flood. Now, many cultures, you know, in prehistoric times, that from oral traditions, the Epic of Gilgamesh, and there's many Asian mythologies about a worldwide flood. One of two things is possible. One, there really was a worldwide flood for everybody to have been touched by it and have a story about it. The other possibility is someone came up with that story and shared it with all the people around them, and that story, you know, filtered out from there. Both are possible, and neither one can be proven. So there you go. And one could argue, if you really start, I'm sure there are, you know, Klingon historians and there are Klingon archaeologists. That's not what I do. That's not, you know, I'm aware of those things, right? I don't dismiss those things, but that's, you know, I am open to say, to helping someone who believes, you know, Kalis didn't really exist. No, he didn't. But these stories absolutely do. You learned them. You've read them. they contain truths, and our society is based on them. That makes them real. Those lessons are valuable. Yeah.
I think, too, that's the difference between a cleric and an archaeologist.
Right.
The archaeologist would want to know the guy's name. The cleric is going to go, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
What his name was. He faced the wind, and he shouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. And think about it from the point of view of that person, right? Okay. Whether it's the fool that was, you know, killed by a windstorm because he, you know, the wind does not respect a fool, or the unnamed woman who touched the garment of Jesus and was healed, right? We don't know their names, but can you imagine being that person and going, you mean I'm going to be remembered forever as a character in this great epic story? That's pretty cool. That's having a real impact on history, even if my name isn't remembered.
Actually, I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, Kalis would have been out there with the fool if he'd stopped to take the time to ask the guy's name instead of getting into shelter.
That's a very good point. I didn't stop to ask the dingbat's name. I just got back inside. That's an excellent point. But yeah, that is the basic groundwork of the Klingon cleric. And in tandem with that, in parallel, you know, not only in character do you have to consider the differences in perspectives and points of views and the contradictions of lore, different, what would you call it, denominations, maybe, of Klingon beliefs. Because, for example, you know, you have the followers of Kalis, but in an episode of Voyager, several episodes of Voyager, actually, we find out that there's a sect of Klingons that believe in the Kuvama, a messianic type character that's been prophesized that will, you know, I don't remember what the Kuvama was supposed to do. I got to look back in my notes. But, and not all Klingons necessarily followed that, but there was this sect that literally went to the Delta Quadrant looking for this Kuvama, which they chose to believe was Miral Paris, you know, the daughter of B'Elanna. So,
which gets you thinking, are there other sects, denominations of Klingon mythology that we're not exposed to?
Absolutely. They're being revealed all the time in you know, the lore of the show, and that's what I was leading up to. I mean, now we also know that sometime less than a generation before the days of Kirk, there was a great warrior, you know, who had to reunify the Klingons, T'Kuvma, you know, and then his successor Lorel became a chancellor, right? So, and that's the parallel that I was going to point out, that not only do you have all these different beliefs within the Klingons, but you have a lot of different beliefs within the fandom of people that are Star Trek fans. So you have to deal with, you know, is this show, is this game, is this book, is this, you know, really, you know, canon, you know? And let's face it, from show to show right now, we're having that debate going on. And it's the same thing. I have the same answer. Depends on what you believe, right? I'm here to help you out with whatever you believe. You know, what do you think? Well, I refuse to watch that show. I don't believe that's canon. Okay, fine. Then it's not. Let's look at what you do believe in.
And Jim, I think we saw this similar thing in that trilogy of pretty much the belief in Captain Kurg and his followers that were the, I'm drawing a blank on what they were called now.
They were a large group of discommodated Klingons calling themselves the Unsung in the Prey trilogy by John Jackson Miller.
Are those canon? I don't know. But
that's a good question, because there's a lot of material in the novels that we don't see, even in the Klingon Empire travel.
Also by Keith, right.
He talks about, no, that was by Dayton Ward, I believe.
Oh, no, you're right. You're right. Thank you.
But he has a whole section on Borath in there.
Yep. I've got the book. I love that. I pretty much use that as my headcanon for what it's like to be on that planet. Then we have a season of Star Trek Discovery that returns to Boreth, and it looks very, very different. It looks like a Gothic cathedral, you know, and the uniforms are different. Then again, one could argue the Klingons look different. So, I mean,
what's at least 30% different.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well,
I throw that out there because that was the contract thing that CBS right. had to make them look all 30% different.
Yeah, and that gets really, really meta, because then you start talking about the whys and what fors of licensing and intellectual property, which I think is way beyond the scope of this.
Way beyond having fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it certainly is like a bucket of cold water sometimes, but the fact remains, though, that clearly there is this a re-acknowledgement of the monastery. Okay, fine. So it's going to look different on the inside. Maybe we only saw, you know, the fire caves when Worf was there, but they were, you know, in an upper section that actually had the towers and the insides of the building that, you know, we see the exterior, but we didn't see it, you know, from the inside the way, you know, because they cheaped out on the sets and whatnot. Okay, fine. I can deal with that. You know, this one particular Klingon happened to have different robes. Okay, fine, whatever. And I'm certainly not going. I don't think if you're going to be a monk, you know, at a monastery, I don't think they're going to sweat you too much for, you know, uniform. It's meant to be kept simple. You know, so just like you see much variation between Klingon uniforms, he's wearing a robe. I don't care if it's brown or bluish green or, you know, it's a rope, you know, but.
I was going to correct you, though, that if you're in the Catholic religion, mm-hmm. yes, it's all highly uniform.
True. That's very, very true.
But like you said.
But the Unitarians would be like, uniforms. Yeah, whatever, you know.
But even, like you said, the Klingon uniform, military uniforms are not even uniform.
Exactly. Exactly. Because I do feel like there does seem to be this sense among Klingons that those things aren't really that important. What do I care if you've got your green side or the right side? What I'm a little more concerned about is how good you are at fighting. You know? And there is something kind of refreshing about that kind of a philosophy, right? Don't sweat the small stuff. Sweat the big stuff. You know, focus on what's important. I think too many people get too focused on the minutiae. And can't see the forest for the trees, so to speak. But I do run into that a lot of times at conventions. I'll have people trying to trip me up with little bits of canon and stuff like that. And I address it, you know, pretty much that way in character. But if it eventually gets disruptive, you know, I'll step aside and step out of character and go, come on, don't be a troll. You know, let's have fun here. Put it aside. Let's move on.
And it's like you were saying earlier with the wind does not respect a fool, gentlemen.
Yeah.
If the storyteller had been able to snap out a name for mm-hmm. the character, I'd be more inclined to believe that he made it up on the spot.
Right. That's a good point. That's an excellent point. And let's face it, from the point of view of the clerics who created a clone of Kalish, right? And they, you know, programmed him, for lack of a better term, with the lore, okay? They didn't fill in those kinds of details, and that was the story point that they were getting at. So if he did come up with a name on the spot, he'd be adding to the lore. And that's not truthful, right? And I don't think Kalish would do that. I don't think he would intentionally lie. I mean, look at the story of the fight he had with his brother over a lie, right? So
and what's the point? Because the point is the story, and the story is the moral that he's trying to teach.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You know? And yeah, when it comes down to it, what is the purpose of this code? This code is to give you a framework for your life, right? And sometimes the why and what fors aren't really that important. It's, you know, I hate to sound to trivialize it too much, because I do remember growing up in a religious home. You know, why do we believe this? Oh, I don't know. It's just what we believe. You know, yeah, well, you might want to chew on it a little bit more than that. You know, there's definitely some value in understanding why, but when you have a philosophy, when you understand why honor is valuable, why it unifies the Klingon people, why the unity of the Klingon people is so important to the individual and to the society, then you try picking apart the legends that teach why it's important. Why would you do that, right? I mean, that's like trying to tear down your house to figure out why it's so important to have a good, steady foundation. There's probably another way to go about learning those kinds of lessons.
Well, really, I would only think the only reason you tear down your house was to figure out how to build more of them.
Well, yeah, I suppose so. But yeah, that doesn't seem to be the typical Klingon way. The typical Klingon way is, you know, this is how it's done. We've done it all this time. It works for us. Why ruin a good thing? And you know, it has come up many, many times. Well, is there a stagnation in certain areas? Do they not progress because they are so conservative? You know what? I think every society deals with that on a generational basis. You know, that is that's not something that you solve in a Sunday service. You know, that's a question for the ages. Yeah, that's my role as a Klingon cleric. And that's how I tend to balance not only the in-character cleric, but the out-of-character, you know, addressing culture and canon and a disagreement over smooth and bumpy heads, so to speak.
We don't talk about that.
Right. Not with outsiders. Presumably amongst ourselves, we just might. But yeah, I mean, those are the things you live for as a fan, right? When the lore fixes itself, when you have, you know, Worf saying we don't discuss it with outsiders, and you go, I see what they did there. And then you have the Enterprise episode where they go, oh no, yeah, that fan theory that's been going around from the role-playing game and whatnot, yeah, we're gonna canonize that. It was a, you know, genetic manipulation that caused it, and it caused this crisis, and you know, it was a generational thing. I'm like, okay, and it's answered, done.
And we turn around and conclude it in a novel in the Star Trek series. They talked about it in Forged by Fire with the albino kind of solving the problem, but Sulu and the trio of Klingon warriors working on it.
There is another piece of EU that tries to tackle it too. I mentioned the Huvama. Well, in Star Trek Online, which takes place right around the time Picard would be taking place right now, Miral Paris has grown up, and there's this whole storyline that involves time travel and her being captured by this sect of Klingons that want to take her back in time and use her genetic material to cure the augment virus. And they talk about before she was born, she healed our people or something like that. And I'm like, well, that's a pretty cool idea that prophecies are made because of some kind of time travel. And then when you start looking at Discovery and you see the Klingons of Boreths being the keepers of a temporal device, you know, I hate the fact that they said time crystals, because that's not what time crystals are. Time crystals are an absolutely real thing, but that's not what was shown in Star Trek, you know. For a show that has a line like, I like science, I wish they'd be a little bit more true to science. But be that as it may, if there is such a thing as a time crystal that allows you to see different times and affect different times and maybe even travel through time, I could totally see it being safeguarded in a monastery. So
let's weave back now to conventions for a bit.
Sure.
You talked about how you've run into some people at conventions who try and nitpick
Klingon
history. Can you go into a few examples of that? try to get the idea being trying to get people to see that they could take on these roles at conventions,
sure,
and have experiences.
Sure. So you have to look, if you are going to do any kind of presenting where you're going to interact with people, take questions, and have a back and forth with people, you got to play the diplomat a little bit, right? So I already addressed how you have to kind of be relaxed about canon. Everyone has a different idea of canon, and, you know, just like from the Klingon point of view, you know, there's different interpretations to the mythology. So, you know, I'm not saying one is any more right than the other. I have my own views, and I totally respect yours. But what will oftentimes happen, because you are presenting yourself as an authority, you know, and in character, you always have the goofball. If it was the internet, you'd say it was the internet troll who is trying to get you to break character, trying to trip you up just because they're trolling. So they will point out, well, wait a minute, because Worf said that you don't have gods because you killed them all because they were too much trouble. But then, you know, you have clerics and religion and this and that. How can you have a religion? Well, on your planet, you have Taoism, right? You have Shintoism, right? You have Buddhism. And whether or not Buddhism has a god or not is arguable, but Shintoism doesn't. It's a philosophy. That's a lot like how the Klingons are.
And Worf learned everything from books.
Right, exactly. And that's another point that I often bring up, that when Worf talks about Klingon culture and when Spock talks about Vulcan culture, they are not necessarily the best representations of their people. Worf grew up among humans, so it's all secondhand from him. I mean, that's like learning a language in your high school from someone who is teaching you the academic language. It's going to be very, very different than if you go to that country and try to speak it there. There's a learning curve there. Well, Worf has many times seen that he had a bit of a learning curve when he had to deal with the Klingons directly. And the Klingons that he interacted with oftentimes didn't have a great deal of respect for him because they saw him as not a true Klingon. It's interesting. What does it mean to be a true Klingon? That you have Klingons that would look at Worf, who is full-blooded Klingon, and not see him as a true Klingon. But then they could look at someone like Jadzia. Dax was definitely a Klingon as far as they were concerned, right? And she was not in any way, not a single drop of Klingon blood in her lineage. Because it's not about the biological makeup. It's who you are as a being. It was
the Curzon in her.
Exactly. Well, it was the Dax in her. That's what they recognized. It was that this is somebody who has proven themselves to have the understanding of our way, to live our way and honor it. So they accepted her as a Klingon, whereas Worf hadn't quite earned that yet. I think as time goes by, he did, because he certainly had a very important role. I mean, by the time he kills Gowron and then chooses not to take on the chancellorship himself and give it to Martok, okay, that's a Klingon. There's no one that's going to... Anyone who wasn't willing to challenge Gowron for his seat of power, they're not going to go after the guy that just killed him. That's the Klingon way. You earn respect that way.
You talked about at conventions having that uber nerd trying mm-hmm. to pick your position apart. Were you doing panels or talks?
So I've done the most common panel that I've done is to kind of go into and it actually got to be such a big thing, I had to break it up into two different panels. I would do Klingon history from the dawn of time to like the original series era. And then I would do a second panel that would be, you know, the Kirk era on up to, I guess now the Picard era. And I would do the whole, you know, this was how it was formed. And then the gods created the first Klingon named KOTOR and his spouse, and together they slew their creators because they were Klingon. And for this, KOTOR was condemned to be the ferryman of the Barge of the Dead. You know, we go on, and I do get into, you know, a little bit of pseudo-historical, archaeological-ish, you know, the first Klingon settlements and, you know, separate tribes and, you know, so on and so forth. But yeah, keeping it pretty generic. Every culture would have something like that, but, you know, it's never been really specified in any kind of lore. And I got a slideshow that goes with it and everything. And yeah, and good times. And, you know, and most people take it in the spirit that it's intended. I've even had people, and I frame it in the way that I took this from the Klingon Christmas Carol. If you've ever seen the Klingon Christmas Carol, it's presented as though it is a class in culture given at the Vulcan Academy. It is narrated by a Vulcan. It is expounded on in that way. Well, I do something very similar. I present myself as Kartan. I am a cleric of the Monastery of Boroth. I have been asked here by Darbase Indy or wherever we are to give this instructive lesson on Klingon history, Klingon culture, whatever, whatever. I have been told that this fills a Klingon culture 101 elective for Starfleet Academy, but I can't speak to that. You might want to speak to your guidance counselor about that, you know, and, you know, kind of take it from there. Even to the point where I even have put together like a, because I like to put together, I like to reference where I take everything from. Because just as I was saying earlier that, you know, there's different canon, some of it is a canon, some of it is expanded universe, some of it you might consider canonical, you might not, whatever. This way I can say that one thing that, you know, you're curious about, that came from Star Trek Online. Oh, well, I don't consider that canon. Okay, well, there you go. You can ignore that, you know. And so for every point, I, you know, so I basically hand it out as a syllabus. Anyone that wants to take a syllabus on their way out, you know, with references, you can do that. And
for those of you that aren't familiar with the Klingon Christmas Carol, it's basically a narrated story by a Vulcan person, mm-hmm, about a character who's a Klingon moneylender that has not gone through the rite of ascension and his struggles to eventually decide to go through the rites of ascension.
Right. And
so it was a good cultural piece.
And that's actually a great, great segue, because there are a number of different ceremonies that we have seen in, especially in Next Gen. We have seen a Klingon wedding. We've actually seen two different styles of Klingon wedding, right? So, you know, you might have a Christian wedding, or you could have a Jewish wedding, or you could have a secular wedding. These are going to be very different ceremonies, right? Well, we've seen two different kinds of Klingon weddings in Star Trek. So I actually have performed the more formal Klingon wedding as a, you know, vow renewal at one convention. There is the Rushtai, which is the bonding of two families together. I have performed that at private gatherings, you know, the joining of Klingon houses. There is, of course, the Age of Ascension. I did that one time at a private gathering because someone was having a birthday and they had just joined CAG. So I'm like, I pulled out my pain sticks and, you know, we had a Age of Ascension ceremony. So, and all of these things, they could be done at conventions where appropriate. There's all kinds of need for those kinds of things.
As a cleric, you kind of have a responsibility to handle these type, yep, of ceremonies.
Yep, yep.
How many do you have in your bag of tricks?
Well, let me take a look here. So I have the, okay. So there is, well, I haven't necessarily performed all of them, so from a practical standpoint, they don't all necessarily have an application yet. But
you want to do them.
Exactly. So you have the... So for example, here's one that I actually have done. It was a little tongue-in-cheek, though. So there's the Jachuk, right? The succession ritual, right? Which is really, that's the Klingon ceremony performed by candidates during the rite of succession. So you have to go into first what is the position that is being vacated, and usually the reason they're being vacated is because the person dies. So I've actually, had a situation where someone was retiring from being the captain of a ship, and we went through the motions of, okay, sit in the chair, pretend to be dead, and we hit him with a pain stick. He doesn't move. I said, okay, he's dead, and then the person taking his place, had to, if there was, first we asked if there was a challenge to the person that was stepping up, right? If there had been, then we would have gone through the rite of succession. We'd have had an arbiter succession, all that sort of thing. But of course there wasn't. There was only one person ever willing to even take the job. So they just said, well, my qualifications are this and this and this and this. Okay, you're now captain of the IKV, whatever it was. And, there you go.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yep. So there's the first rite of succession, which, is far more passe than the second rite. The first rite of succession is really for children, right? When they reach the age of inclusion and they declare that they're going to be a warrior. Then there's the second rite of ascension, and that's, the ceremony that I performed when, she just turned 21, I think it was, and we bought her a bottle of scotch, and then we put her through the Nente Chadich, where, she had to walk through us, reciting, I must show you my heart, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you grade her on how well she showed her pain?
Well, it's pass fail. either you pass or you fail, and she passed. Like I said, I did a Rustai, the bonding ceremony, where it was actually myself and Mark, Marak, the sector head. We joined our houses into House Tokul. The Tochte, which is the wedding, I've performed at conventions. And the one that I haven't done yet, and I haven't completely fleshed out yet in notes, is the Kakad, which is the challenge of spirit. It's from the novel The Farther Shore, and it's taken by warriors that wish to hunt the dangerous animals native to different worlds of the Klingon Empire. It's a hunting ritual, so that would be a little bit more of a challenge. So unless, there was a real need to explore that, I don't actually see role-playing that out. But you never know. We'll see what comes in the future.
I know one that we've tried is Klingon speed dating.
Klingon speed dating. Okay, so now we're going kind of more into fanon, which is fan canon.
It's a line that Worf used on Next Gen.
Well, we've done it. So I'm guessing that what we've done is very similar to what you're talking about then.
I stole it from you guys. I saw the video.
Oh, you're talking about where we were throwing the tribbles and reciting the poetry. We are really pushing to expand that particular event far more with the Klingon Language Institute, because we really want to push people to use the language to create poetry. So that really is, as much fun as that is and silly, there's nothing wrong with that, but we do want to push the language a little bit more. So we are starting to challenge people to, if they have taken the introductory language class that's taught at a convention, and learn the basics and they've got their Klingon dictionary. Okay, you actually need to write a Klingon poem in Klingon and then present it while your significant other is pelting you with tribbles or other objects.
I'm lucky if I can get the guys to read the silly love songs that I printed out for them.
As a side note, something else that I do every Friday on the YouTube channel, The Latino Slant, he does karaoke, and he has a different theme. So this past week was 70 songs. So I picked 270 songs, and I had to prepare them for over a week. And next week, there's actually a competition for the theme. We have to each pick two songs, one by Prince and one by David Bowie. And I have to really practice if I want any chance at winning that competition. So I see absolutely no reason to not, you know, if you have, if you're trying to learn the Klingon language and you went to the class, well, okay, you have 8 hours to, you know, when you go to lunch and, you know, whatever, sit with your dictionary and the basics that you've got and try to put together a love poem. Or if you want to get real bold, you can try to translate a song or something like that. Or if you want to cheat a little bit, go out and find one of the songs that's already been translated and do that. But they're still going to have to practice it so that you're ready to go.
Oh, I don't require them to sing it.
No, not sing.
Words.
Recite. And I'll tell you, the thing is, you're in front of an audience that doesn't, most of them probably don't know Klingon. The judging isn't done necessarily by people who are fluent in Klingon. The judging is done by, I don't know who the judges are. It depends on the convention. So if you go up there and you don't know a lick of Klingon and you screw up a pronunciation or you have to make up some words, if you do it forcefully and with conviction,
nobody will know.
Most people won't know the difference. I could see Jeremy in the back scratching his head going, the heck is that word? But other than that, you know, he'd probably chuckle and go, I know what he's doing. But
or,
yeah.
Or just have the lady throw one of the stuffed animals at Jeremy.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, exactly.
I saw a bunch of those stuffed animals in you guys' video.
Yep.
Go towards the judges.
Oh, yeah. No, it got crazy that night. And that's where the fun comes in. That, speaking of the tribbles, though, that's something else that I'm working on. I got a little obsessive about that. Again, I'm going to reference back to Star Trek Online. Tribbles are a thing in Star Trek Online. If you have a tribble in your inventory and there's any food there, those tribbles will eat the food and multiply. Well, keep in mind, tribbles are a creature that, you know, are self-propagating, right? They are, how did McCoy put it? They're born pregnant. Well, I don't think that you're literally born pregnant, but they don't require genetic, you know, input from another tribble to reproduce. So how do you get variations in tribbles? It's mutations. And those mutations are based on or can occur based on what they've eaten. So in Star Trek Online, you literally can breed tribbles with different foods to get different styles and looks of tribbles. And in game, they have different effects, right? So your basic tribble, you know, makes you feel relaxed and, you know, maybe adds a hit point or two or whatever. Well, depending on what their environment is and what the food was they ate. For example, if you find yourself or you've bred yourself a winter tribble, okay, which looks like red and white stripes, by feeding a regular tribble food that you got from Q's Winter Wonderland during the winter event, that tribble cures some hit points, gives you traction when you are moving on ice, and helps you resist cold damage. So, obsessive person that I am, because what are we? We are fans. What are fans? We are fanatics. I've started collecting all the different tribbles that appear in Star Trek Online. And I have a Borg Tribble, and I have a Winter Tribble, and I have a Ricin Tribble, and I've got a genetically modified Safe Tribble, which you saw in the J.J. Abrams film, right? They are modified to not reproduce. But they are based visually on a similar genetically modified Tribble that was shown in the original series. Therefore, they are pink, original the animated series, right? So what I want to do is I want to put together like a Tribble zoo for display at conventions, you know, like maybe segmented plexiglass kind of a design with a different Klingon, with the different Tribbles in there with a Klingon name on it on the outside with the technical name for that breed of Tribble in Klingon and in English. And I think that might be kind of fun.
Speaking of Tribbles, we recently did a cooking video where we had three different recipes for cooking the varmints.
It's very interesting. I was thinking of doing that myself. There are two dishes for that you can use Tribbles for in Star Trek Online. Only Klingons can make it, though. And that is Tribble kebabs and Tribble souffle. I'm thinking about making doing a video for those dishes myself. What did you guys do?
We had basically Tribbles in a blanket, Tribble meatballs, and a baked Tribble meatball. All three of those recipes, by the way, are in the mind scanner.
Oh, cool, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I did a Borath cleric soup.
Wow.
Yeah, I completely made it up.
I would love to check that out. Where can I find that?
We did a podcast on it.
Oh, so it's on your podcast. Okay.
It's on the podcast channel. All you have to do is type
in pause and writing down the ingredients.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You just go in there and listen, and I'll give you step-by-step instructions.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Over on my YouTube channel, I have up a recipe for gach that I have been told is the best in this quadrant. I can't speak to that, but I think it's pretty good.
You should.
Well, the way I said it is, look, when you're away from the Klingon homeworld, getting fresh gach sometimes can be a challenge, you know? So sometimes you have to improvise. And
hey, if you come up with it, you should think it's good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, I've made this recipe. I came up with this recipe originally based on the recipe for gach in the Star Trek cookbook, Neelix's.
Which is in Mind Scanner, too.
Yeah. Well, there's all different recipes for gach out there, right? But the
in Mind Scanner, yeah.
Yeah. But the one that I started with was the one in the Star Trek cookbook. But that's no longer what it is. It's definitely, you know, Kartan's gach, you know, and I think it's really good. Everybody in my sector thinks it's good. So I even have one Klingon who's allergic to onions. So I make her a completely separate batch with no onions.
Well, seeing as how we're trying to do some cooking podcasts, mm-hmm. 5 to 10 minutes long, take a listen to a couple. See if you're willing to record one.
You bet. Absolutely.
More recipes out there are always the better. But getting back to clerics,
mm-hmm.
which is what we're here for.
I would argue, however, that talking food is talking culture. And that's part of our topic. But yes, let's get back to the main topic.
Oh, I don't disagree with you. That's why I never cut you off.
Food, language, and culture. The three go hand in hand.
So I guess we've talked about what we can do at conventions. We've talked about what Klingon clerics are.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the next thing that we should look at, and I'm pretty sure this is going to have to be a separate podcast or more parts of the series, is looking at Kalus's life and the legends that go around him.
Absolutely.
So can we look forward to this as a future podcast from you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say the very next one, we're going to actually specifically have to start talking about the story of Kalus. Sure. Absolutely.
So with that in mind, I'd like to sign this particular podcast off for this evening. And to everyone out there who's listening, kapla.